Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men, to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners, to be seen by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father, who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. This, then, is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. Forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For if you forgive men when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their sins, your Father will not forgive your sins. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to men that you are fasting, but only to your Father, who is unseen, and your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you.
Hi everyone, I'm not sure everybody knows me. Some of you will know me from being at Kensington. Many of your kids I know. Some of you will know me from Cattle Country, because I think some of you came along to that as well. I'm Stuart Heap. I'm one of the elders at Kensington. I'm also someone who does children's work there, which I've been doing for a long, long time. In some cases to second generation now, which is really nice to be working with the kids of some of the people we work with. So that is a real treat. One of the things I am not is coordinated. So if you think about TV shows and reality TV shows, me being on Strictly Come Dancing may not be one of them. But we really enjoy that show. We quite enjoy one or two reality TV shows. We really enjoy that one as a family. And I rashly decided before Christmas that as my wife really would like to do something like dancing, that I could get lessons for her, ballroom dancing lessons for her, ballroom dancing lessons for me, and I would step boldly out of my comfort zone, as I sometimes expect her to do. So we just had two lessons, and I've done the rhythm foxtrot, which apparently is easier than the ordinary foxtrot, but I wouldn't know that. I've done the quick step, and the guy said to me, we'll play the music now, can you hear the beat? There's four beats here. Could I tell which was the first one? Never mind. But when he pushes me around and says the different words, then we sort of get there. We've done the rumba. We did the New York walk, whatever that might have been, as well. But I will not be on that one. But another show that I've quite enjoyed is Secret Millionaire. Now, I'm not a millionaire, but I quite fancy going on there. That would be quite a good one to go on. Gives you a nice feeling, doesn't it? You go along there, undercover, go and meet some people working in a charity, make a difference for people who are rich, or are not rich because of your richness, and help people who are needy. And that would give quite a nice feeling. But imagine that show had a slightly different format, in that wherever the guy goes or the woman goes, the face is all blurred out like they do on TV. When you get to the end, instead of him coming out of his secrecy and saying, "I'm actually a millionaire and I'd like to give you 20,000, 40,000, 100,000, that he just posts the checks off totally anonymously at the end so nobody ever knows who he is. Would that work as a show? If you were that secret millionaire, would you feel cheated that nobody knew that it was really you that had given? Would you think you've been sort of conned in that?" Well, Jesus has quite a lot to say about that, and that's what we were reading in the first part of the passage that Kate read for us this morning. And we're moving on. If you've been here for the previous ones, we're moving on from aspects of how the Old Testament law was being applied, how people responded to life situations like hatred, lust, divorce, keeping your word, integrity, things like that, into what Jesus is now calling acts of righteousness, and in particular giving to help people who are needy. And these acts of righteousness are positive things, deliberate things that you would choose to do, and that a good Jew in that time would have been doing as part of their devotion to God. So the people listening would have immediately grasped, this is what we do. This is the sorts of things we do. Now, to get to grips with this, and it's only a short passage, we need really to look at three things. One, what are acts of righteousness? Two, hypocrites are mentioned in here, so we need to know who they are. And because it's about giving, and we don't want to end up with a lopsided view, we need to look at what biblical giving is about, because that's what's particularly picked up in this. So if you're now thinking, this is where they're after our money, this isn't where we're after your money. And those are the elements, the foundations we need to put in place so that we can see what Jesus is truly saying. So if we look first at the acts of righteousness, they are positive, deliberate things that a Jew would have been doing. And the first thing we actually notice is that Jesus just used as an assumptive word, when you give to the needy, verse 2, it's not if you choose to do that, it's when. When you pray, which is the next section, which we'll be having in a couple of weeks' time, which is verse 5. When you fast, verse 16. Each one of them were simply assumed to be something that a follower of Jesus would do. And if you look through the rest of the New Testament, you'll find loads of places where these things are just, the Christians are just encouraged to be doing as part of their normal outworking of a desire to live a life that is righteous before God, and it's in response to the righteousness given by God. The second thing we need to pick up as background is, what are hypocrites? What are they like? These are the people that we are told we shouldn't be like. The dictionary says a hypocrite is someone who pretends to have virtues, morals, or religious belief. The Greek word that's used here means an actor on a stage, somebody looking for applause. So it's really an actor performing for the applause of other people. So it's somebody who really isn't for real. Now, I don't know how you pass your time as you travel, if you've got children. We've driven many a mile with our children, and something that happened this week just reminded me of the way we have passed that time. Because Mr. Tumpy's caravan, which you've probably never heard of, has been written by Enid Blyton, but nobody ever found the manuscript, and it was a finished story. Now, we've sat there in our car, slotting tapes in those days, CDs in, with loads of Mallory Towers stories, Famous Five, Secret Seven, and we've loved them. They overflow with good moral values, really nice family stories, moral decency. I then watched a documentary about Enid Blyton. She was a miserable, manipulative, terrible woman. She was nothing like her stories. She was not a good wife. She manipulated her children into performing so that she would look like the perfect English family. And she was nothing like you would expect her to be. But her public image was such a powerful, strong, well-valued English woman. But she was just a hypocrite. We don't like them. I felt quite saddened by that. In fact, we often use the word hypocrite to insult people. And we immediately, of course, assume that we aren't one. But as we examine God's word in this area, let's just think about whether there is some hypocrisy within our lives. In this passage, the hypocrites are most likely the Pharisees, and their religious life, as we've already seen in previous weeks, was really like an act. It was a show on stage designed to bring glory for themselves and status. It says their so-called acts of righteousness were self-glorification. Announce it with trumpets to be honoured by men, it says in verse 2. And the third one we need to grasp to get the background is Christian giving. Now this bit's about giving to the needy. It's not about other aspects, but we need to see where that's coming from. There's two elements to Christian giving. The first is this, structured regular giving. And 1 Corinthians 16 says this, "Now about the collection for God's people, do what I told the Galatian churches. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made." So that bit is straightforward. We give regularly, and in this case it says weekly, but maybe because the world is different, it's now monthly. We are to set aside a proportion of our income for God's people, which is the church. And note it's on the first day of the week, which is actually telling us it's not what we have left at the end, if we do have any left. This is something set aside at the start. So that's the first element of Christian giving. And the second is this, spontaneous giving to the poor and the needy, which is what this passage is describing. If you think we've already set aside our regular planned giving, our structured giving, then this automatically becomes over and above what we would normally do. But before we then move on, I want us just to look at Matthew 6:24, which comes up in three sessions, 4 weeks' time on this. And just pause and think about what Jesus is saying about the rivalry that money and God can have. Because he aligns these two together as rivals of each other. He says this, "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Therefore, what we're looking at this morning, if we are serious about God, is something that actually is important. Because money is probably one of those things that has a really big grip, or can have a really big grip on our lives. I also want to cover off, as we look at giving, just a few biblical principles. And the first one is this, that giving is for our benefit. Sometimes we think the church runs because people give. But if you stop and think, before anybody ever started giving, God created and ran the whole universe. And he did it quite easily without us. Now that might sort of just push you down a little bit. He's actually quite able to extend his kingdom without our giving, because he's able to do whatever he chooses. But giving has been designed for our benefit and for our blessing. And that actually just helps position us where we are and where God is, because sometimes we think it's us that do these things. Let me just explain what I mean. Deuteronomy says this: count off 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing corn, then celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God by giving a freewill offering in proportion to the blessing the Lord your God has given you. So if you think about your income, wherever that comes from, and you might be a wage person or you may get income from another source, the blessing of income, what you have, is from God. He's blessing you with that. Therefore, we give as a free will, a gift in gratitude to God. Now, we're probably not farmers here. I doubt any of us are. But if you think of the farmer, if we don't go out and sow, then nothing grows. The farmer sows, it grows. He then is blessed by God. He then goes and sows, it grows, he's blessed, and it goes in a cycle. And that's the same in a sense with us. We work, if that's what we do, God blesses us, and we give, and that cycle goes on. And in giving, we actually open our hands and our wallets and recognize where our earnings come from. Now, I used to work, I don't work in this job anymore, I used to work in a job where I had many a target to deliver with pots of money that I would achieve when I got to those things. And it's really, really easy if you're in that environment and you say, we need to bring in this number of millions of pounds worth of business. I've got there, I'm at 32 million, my target was 30. Is that brilliant? Have I earned a lot of money or not? Let's go and collect the bonus. I really like this. And it is so easy then to think, I've done it. It's me. Am I clever? Did I get that lot selling? Yes, I did. We delivered the goods. But that's not what the Bible is actually telling us. It's telling us that what we have is a blessing the Lord has given us. Think back to that farmer. If he just did his sowing once, and his reaping once, and thanked God once to recognize God's goodness, that's the actual end of it. It's a cycle that we enter into that God is wanting to bless us with. If you look at Proverbs 11 verse 24, which links to this cycle of blessing as we give, one man gives freely, yet gains even more as God blesses. Another withholds unduly and comes to poverty. And Paul says this as he draws these thoughts together. Remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows generously will also reap generously. Then see the link. Each man should give what he has decided to give in his heart. Now some people, and particularly if you go to the US, would actually say, this is a financial equation. The bank of God is giving the best monetary return on investment that you can get. In other words, the more you give, the wealthier you become, so therefore give a lot. And in some churches in the US, they would actually preach that. In fact, in many churches in Africa, they would preach that same sort of message. But it is actually much wider than that. Because we have to understand who God is. And God is sovereign. And God is good. And he is good all the time. Everything he does is good. And what he wants for us is to do us good. He wants to bless us. Therefore, if we are giving to him, if we are showing our dependence on him in that way, he promises, as we'll see in this passage, to reward us. But the best thing he can actually do for us is to transform us so that we are like Christ. That is his primary aim for those who come to know him. And that will be the reward that he wants to give us. Now, he may bless us financially in that process, and he may be doing that we might give to a particular work or to people in need. And that might, in his wisdom, be a choice. But he is doing it to bless us in his wisdom. So that is our first principle, that giving is for our benefit. The others are quicker than that. Giving is sacrificial. Really struck me when I read a little bit in Mark 12 about the rich people and the poor woman who were giving, the poor widow. The rich people threw in their money, as the word says, whilst the poor widow put in two small, very small copper coins. And Jesus said this, they gave out of their wealth, but she out of her poverty put in everything, all she had to live in. It cost her to give. It was sacrificial. King David said this, I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing. Somebody was trying to give him something, some animal that he could sacrifice. You have it for free. And he said, I'm not going to do that. This should cost me something. It should be sacrificial. Giving is proportional to income. That's my third one. And we've read this passage already. Each one should set aside a sum in keeping with his income. And if you think about it, we would want to do that, because if God is blessing us in that way, we would want to be grateful for that. Giving is not just for the wealthy. Who has enough here? I'm not asking you to put your hand up. Usually, and I'm like this, I think I could just do with just a touch more. If I had just a little bit more, that would be good. Why did Wayne Rooney go through all that game he did to hold Manchester United to ransom, even though he's a very wealthy man, just to get a little bit, in fact, a bit, lot bit more? That's what it was about. And if you think to yourself, I'll wait till I've got that buffer, those big chunk of savings, that spare cash every month that's there at the end of the month and I don't know what to do with it, then you will never, ever get to the stage of handing over control of money to God. Luke 16 says this, whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? So if you're saying, I've only got a little bit, I've got to keep that to myself because I couldn't possibly trust God to supply my needs, then why should God trust you with more? Fifth one, God giving is bound to spiritual riches. The last line that I just read is this. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches, with spiritual riches, what's really important in life? Why should God do that? And if your desire here is to be used by God, to be blessed in your own life, to be a blessing in the life of other people, that the ministry you're involved in will be blessed by God, will be seeing fruit, but you're gripping closely to your money because you're saying, I'm not trusting you with that, God, then why should God bless you with real riches, with people turning to the Lord, with people growing in their knowledge of him? Why should he do that? Number six is giving should be personally determined. We read earlier, each one should give what he has decided in his heart to give. It's not a law, it's not an amount. Give this and you've done enough. Give less, you haven't. It's what God is laying upon your heart to give. And at some stage of your life, it may be actually to give a very large amount of what you earn. At other times, the Lord may be laying on your life to give less. But it's a sensitivity to his spirit that would show us that. It's a cheerful act, that particular verse says. And it's in response to need, as particularly this passage. But Acts 4 also says, talking about the church, all the believers were in one heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had. There were no needy persons among them. Just listen to this line. This is a tough one. From time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them and brought the money from the sales. That was what the early church was like, in saying, yes, you can borrow that. Yes, I'll share that with you. Yes, I will give you that to meet your need. And finally, giving is generous, because what giving is a response to God's overwhelming blessing and goodness. And if you stop and think what we are like as Christians, the righteousness that was talked about, that Dave was talking about at the start, that Christ has given us, that swap that took place, then why would we not be generous in our giving? So that's 8 quick principles, and now we need to move really on to what the passage is talking about, which is giving to the needy. So we'll look at Jesus' warnings, and then we'll draw it together. So what is the principle of giving to the poor? We talked just briefly there of what the early church was like. Let me just read you a couple of bits from the Old Testament where this would have come from. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and is unable to support himself among you, help him as you would an alien or a temporary resident, so that he can continue to live among you. And that was simply an expectation for the Israelites, that if somebody became poor and unable to support themselves, so this isn't some lazy old so-and-so, then they were expected to help them. Deuteronomy 15 says, however, there should be no poor among you, for in the land the Lord your God is giving you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you if only you fully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all these commands I am giving you today. And that just reveals how we mess things up. And if there is a poor man among your brothers in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, listen to the attitude here. Do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards your brother. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. So maybe you're thinking there, I've only got to lend him the stuff and I'll have it back. Verse 10 then goes on to say, give generously to him. And again, look at the heart attitude. And do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, and think about the cycle of blessing we talked about, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. It's an expectation that was there on the people of Israel. Therefore, they would have understood this. Now, there's 2 ways that Jesus talks about giving to the needy, and he hits in this passage the wrong one first. And if you think about this, this is giving, but whatever you do, this applies also. So if it's setting the PA up here, if it's leading a service, if it's teaching the children, if it's helping your neighbour or somebody at work, the principles Jesus teaches here apply. Because what he's highlighting is what our heart attitude, or the why we are doing things. And this comes down to who is on the throne in your life. Who is in charge? It comes down to who we are trusting for blessings. Is it me hitting target and delivering some money in a money sense? And ultimately, who are we trusting for our salvation? And we noted earlier what Jesus said of rivalry of money. And I don't think he says of anything else other than money and God. I think that's the only one he speaks of in that term. So it's a great indicator of our heart's allegiance. Jesus teaches here that there's going to be a reward for acts of righteousness. Verse 2, they have received their reward. And verse 4, your Father who sees in secret will reward you. How we get that reward, that blessing, and from whom we get it, depends upon your heart's attitude. Jesus teaches in the passage that we can have our reward here and now from the people we help, the people we maybe give to, or the people we tell about our acts of righteousness, or the people we're trying to impress. And that's what it means when it says we can be have the honour, we can be honoured by men. And then our prideful hearts become temporarily satisfied. It suddenly is all about me. Have you seen how generous I am? Have you seen how kind I am? Have you seen how well I pray coming up in future weeks? Have you seen how well I fast? It's all about me. The other choice is to enter God's cycle of blessing, be truly satisfied as we recognize the source of our money, that it is from God. And then it says, your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Now, the hypocrites chose to have the honour of men. They designed their giving to achieve that objective, and they got the reward in full from men, and they didn't get it from God. Now, the trumpets that are mentioned here, and you love the imagery of this, people think is the way the Pharisee went out to do his giving. A couple of his mates would go out, probably lowly-ish people, blow trumpets in the streets, which would be to summon the needy. He would then stand probably in an exalted position whilst they came forward to beg for some money from him, which he would then hand over. They get a little bit of a handout and a dose of humiliation, and he would be honoured as a great benefactor. And you can just imagine that. Now, on Monday, and some of you may have heard this guy speak, I went to a meeting with Trevor Archer, who spoke at Kensington last Sunday evening. And he has a vision to get £1 million, a million for ministry, to train new pastors and to help them through that stage of their life. And that is a really good vision to have. And he told us about a church in East London that has people on the breadline, and it has hedge fund managers at the other end of the scale, who are incredibly wealthy. And he told me about one guy, and this was his words, he's just written a cheque, I couldn't do this, for £1 million to a particular Christian charity. And I sat there in the room thinking, God, wouldn't it be good to be that rich? And the sort of image came, the Stuart Heap pastor's training bursary. I could do that. I could support people. I could support people like Johnny and Andy and people like that. Wouldn't that be wonderful? But you see what that is? It's just a desire for pride and recognition. It just rushes in, and I become like the Pharisees, the hypocrites that Jesus is condemning. I'm doing it for my glory and not as part of my devotion to God. It's a statement of, I am so wealthy, I can do this. Aren't I a good guy? But it was actually more than that for the Pharisees, because it often was with them, because they'd added over many years extra significance to giving alms, as this is called, or giving to the needy. Significance that's never there. And in some old writings, the Apocrypha, I just want to read you one or two little passages that come out from there that illustrates this. It says, it's good to do alms rather than treasure up gold, which we'd agree with, but we wouldn't agree the rest of this. For alms deliver from death and will purge away every sin. And another book in that section, alms will atone for sin. And then another of the Jewish writings, the Talmud, alms is a more excellent way than all offerings, never mind what God said in the past, and is equal to the whole law. Alms will deliver from condemnation of hell and make one perfectly righteous. So they had it well and truly stitched up. They were getting praise from men, and that was good, and they were declaring their righteousness before God, and that's so like the British church became, or the British people understood the gospel in days gone by of do good works and you will be fine. And that's not what it is about. And that's maybe you this morning. Maybe you think to yourself, that guy up there has no idea how much money I give to charity. He has no idea how much good work I do. And maybe you're even sat in your mind thinking, I'm just quickly calculating what percentage of my income I give, because you're really proud of that. And you're thinking, I'm sure God will be impressed by the amount that I give. But what these passages have been telling us over the last number of weeks that if we are trusting in acts of righteousness or any other good work, then that will not achieve what we think it might, or we're maybe thinking it will, because Jesus has been saying this: it's only the empty-handed, the poor in spirit, who will be blessed. And that's been the message all the way through Matthew 5 and 6. So that's what Jesus says is not how or why we should give to the needy. But he actually says this: when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving might be in secret. That doesn't fit well with secret millionaire. Then your Father, who sees what you have done, will reward you. Can you see how matter of fact this is? It's just do it. Do it in a way that one half of you doesn't know what the other half has done. So there isn't time for a lot of deliberation. Shall I do it? Shall I not? Can I afford it? Can I not? It's based on the underlying giving principles we looked at, but it's spontaneous. It's just doing it. It's a heart prompted by God's Spirit that says, that person is in need, I can help them, I'll do it. This is love God wants me to show to that person. It's also an expression of trust in God, because I'm giving away some of what I'm thinking is my money, and I'm trusting God to supply my needs. So it's just do it, forget it, and then move on. He's saying do it quietly, do it humbly, don't boast about it, don't talk about it, don't even wait for the thanks of the recipient. Just do it, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And then it says, and your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you, and you continue in God's cycle of blessing. Let me just ask you and me, do we trust God with our money, or do we trust in our money? Do we actually believe that what we have is from God, or do we still harbour those thoughts of, I've done it? And do we value reward from God more than the praise of men that says, isn't he a generous guy? Isn't he a kind person? Hasn't he done well? Isn't he rich? And he gives from it. Do we trust him that he will bless us, that he will reward us, that we are in his circle of blessing as we do this? And do we actually trust him that he will continue to meet our every need? Let me remind you of that verse 24 as we close. No one can serve two masters, Jesus said. Either he will hate one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And our attitude to giving, which is for our benefit, reveals what our heart towards God is like. We're just going to sing to close.